Welcome back to the program. After graduating from Smith College, our guest Piper Kerman fell in with a hard-partying, drug-dealing crowd. 10 years after she left that all behind, her past came back to haunt her. She has chronicled her experiences in her new book, Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. It is my pleasure to have Piper Kerman here on the program today. Piper, thanks so much for joining us.
Yes, thanks for inviting me onto the show.
Great to have you here. First of all, tell us what happened. What happened originally and 10 years later?
Well, as you mentioned, after I graduated from college in the early 90s, like a lot of young people, I was sort of a little bit aimless, not quite sure about my next step. I was waitressing in a microbrewery in New England, which is where I'm from. And I got involved in a relationship with an older woman, a woman who seemed impossibly sophisticated and worldly to me. And she turned out to be involved in drug trafficking. And I followed her around the world and, at her request, carried a bag of money from Chicago to Brussels. Which I certainly knew was not a legit thing to do, not a legal thing to do. And that short period of my life, I think that the simple act of carrying that money really scared the pants off of me in a lot of senses. And shortly after that, I broke ties and broke that relationship off and made my way actually out here to the Bay Area, put my life back together with the help of old friends from college. And other good folks, got a great job, and really thought that I had put that experience, that dalliance with the dark side, in a box and really put it, locked it up and put it at the back of my closet, as it were. And many years later, however, you know, the knock comes on the door, and federal agents came and let me know that I had been indicted in federal court in Chicago for my past actions. And that I would be called into account because, you know, sooner or later, one way or the other, the consequences of our actions do definitely come back to us.
Did you have any idea of what was transpiring at any point during those 10 years?
No, I really had cut all ties. So whatever was going on with my ex-lover, you know, I was not really up to speed with. On the one hand, it was shocking to get that knock on the door, and on the other hand, you know, I had always sort of known that something like that could happen, but enough time had passed that I had sort of started to relax. You know, I was in a very steady relationship. I had just moved to New York City literally a month before I got that knock on the door, and the thing that was really unusual about my case was that knock on the door came. I quickly pled guilty to the offense that I had committed, to that carrying that bag of money. And then a lengthy legal delay happened because the federal government was trying to extradite a drug kingpin from overseas, which they were not successful in doing. But that caused a further delay of almost 6 years. So I didn't walk into prison gates until almost 11 years after I had committed my offense.
Why did the government care after 10 years about this relatively minor offense?
Well, without getting into too much of the legalese,
right.
You know, I am one of 13 people on one indictment, on a single initial indictment. And so at the top of that indictment is this drug kingpin. And literally at the bottom of the indictment is me. And that's pretty typical of conspiracy indictments. You know, the government sort of uses the force of numbers to try to, you know, sort of get as many noses as possible. You know, the growth of our prison system has been tremendous in the last generation, basically. In 1980, we had 500,000 Americans in prison, and now we have 2.3 million Americans in prison. So things like drug cases and nonviolent drug offenders like myself, you know, account for that growth by and large. That's a big change in government policy.
What happened after that knock on the door? What followed?
Well, what initially followed was, of course, you know, sort of the fear and the chaos of contending with the legal system and trying to figure out, you know, what was going to happen next. And then when that delay happened, that was a real a real head scratcher in some ways. I mean, it was a very difficult time. Obviously, my boyfriend and then fiance was completely staunch and a rock, and my family was a rock. I mean, I think the interesting thing about that lengthy delay was that it gave me the chance to sort of work through a lot of the fear and anxiety and dread of going to prison, because frankly, by the time I actually went, I was really ready to get it over with.
How did you begin to process that? How did you begin to reconcile what you were going to have to do?
Well, I mean, I think, as I said, I pled guilty to the offense, and I, you know, as a more grown up and responsible person, you know, I have always taken responsibility for my own actions and for the fact that I did break the law. And so I didn't really have much question, and certainly my attorneys made it clear really quickly that there would not be any wiggling out of prison time on this. That's the way that our drug laws work in this country. And so I did spend a lot of time to both trying to reconcile, you know, in the larger sense, you know, initially sort of feeling like, wow, I've completely ruined my life. But then, you know, as time goes on, you're sort of like, well, my life is continuing, so I guess I'd better get down to living it. And of course, reconciling, you know, the fears about prison itself and all of the images of prison that we have in this country, prisons and prisoners, was something that I spent a lot of time thinking about. And for me, I think it was interesting and challenging because most of the information or misinformation in some cases about prisons and prisoners is about male prisoners and male prisons. And at that time, there was very little information out there about women and prison. So it was hard to find really valuable information to sort of prepare myself for the experience.
And as is pointed out, it is one of the fastest growing segments of the prison population.
It is, and that's part of the reason for the title, Orange is the New Black. Obviously refers to the classic orange jumpsuit that we associate with prisons and prisoners, but it also refers to the fact that, by and large, women are far more likely to be wearing that jumpsuit now, but it is the fastest growing segment.
Do you have a sense as to why that is?
Drug laws, yeah. Mm-hmm. I think when it comes to the female population specifically, very few female offenders are in prison for violent offenses. They're there for drug offenses, or they're there for property-related crimes and sort of the wide array of crimes of fraud, whether it's insurance fraud or stock fraud or, you know, we would refer to those as paper crimes in prison.
Your lawyer tells you before you go into prison that the one thing you should do is not make any friends. Turns out to be not very good advice.
Well, not very realistic advice. I had a wonderful lawyer. I'm very, very fortunate that I was able to afford a private attorney, and a really good private attorney. And that is not the case for most prisoners. Most prisoners are represented by either public defenders or court-appointed lawyers. There is a difference between those two. I don't know how one would navigate the experience of being a prisoner and contending with the prison system without forming friendships on the inside. I mean, quite literally, for your survival, you need those friendships, but also, you know, mentally and emotionally, the isolation of not forging friendships with the women who are going through that kind of experience right by your side is hard for me to imagine, though I think my lawyer's advice was well-intentioned.
Talk about how different the women in prison were from the world that you had inhabited, the world that you were leaving.
Mm-hmm. Well, I come from a very middle-class background. I'm college-educated. I've been working sort of in the professional sphere, you know, certainly most of my adult life in the whole range of capacities, but primarily in sort of communications. When I lived here in San Francisco, I worked for a video production company. Most of the people in the prison system right now, living in the prison system right now, and certainly most of the women that I met in the prisons that I lived in, come from our poorest communities, whether those are urban or rural, and the majority of prisoners do not have a high school education, have not succeeded in getting a high school diploma, and a vast number of people have never worked outside of the underground economy. They've never worked in the legitimate economy. That doesn't mean they haven't worked per se, but you know, I think that folks perhaps underestimate the size of the underground economy and just how many people it employs in this country. And those facts, coupled with a prison sentence, make it really incredibly challenging for many of those folks to, when they complete their prison sentence and they have paid their debt to society for whatever offense they've committed, to come home. And, you know, there's 700,000 prisoners coming home every single year in this country. For those folks to come home and transition their lives into the legitimate economy to work as productive members of society is challenging based on what they had already experienced before they went into prison. And certainly there's nothing happening in prison to change that in a substantial way. Folks often ask me, you know, shouldn't prison be awful so that, you know, folks learn a lesson? And I think there is this strong expectation that the simple fact of confinement and the fact that prisons are, in fact, horrible places is a lesson unto itself. But the truth of the matter is when you're in the midst of it and when you're right up there in the mix of trying to survive prison, that the only lesson that the system is really teaching is how to be a prisoner. That's what you need to learn, and you need to learn it well. You need to learn how to be a prisoner, and you need to know how to navigate that system, which is so unique, that takes place behind bars. The problem is that those lessons do not serve you well when you hit the streets, by any stretch of the imagination. In fact, I think that that is part of the reason that we have such a high number of folks who go back to prison, because they haven't learned any of the skills, you know, while they've been locked up that will help them succeed when they come back.
What are those survival skills? What are those things that it is essential to learn in order to navigate that system?
One of the skills that's really, one of the things that's really, really important to learn in prison is to watch both the system of power that goes on with guards, to really, really observe which guards are by the book and which guards have thrown the book out the window, and how you're going to navigate that. And, of course, to sort of observe what's going on with the other prisoners. And prisoners sort of create their own, I mean, the irony is that prison is, of course, a system that wants to take all power away from the people who live there. But prisoners carve out their own spheres of power, and you have to sort of figure out who runs what kind of systems, either officially or unofficially, within the prison. For example, I became very fast friends with the prisoner who essentially ran the kitchen with a bit of an iron fist. And prisoners carve out other areas of strength. And you have to sort of figure that out. And you do have to figure out how you're going to negotiate the experience with the authority figures, the staff within the prison, which can be very risky and can also be sort of neglectful. Those are really, really important things that you have to figure out. And you can only really figure out those things by observing for yourself, because initially when you arrive in prison, you don't really know who you can trust in that setting. So it's best to sort of keep your mouth shut and your eyes open.
What are the risks in making the wrong decisions in those relationships and those situations?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think in some prisons the risk is violence, and I think that some prisons are very violent places. That was not true in the prisons that I found myself in. As I said, female offenders are very rarely serving time for violent crimes. And during the time that I was locked up in prison, I actually never saw an act of physical violence between two prisoners. That doesn't mean that folks don't manipulate or intimidate. And frankly, among females, I think that there is a much stronger reliance on some of the social pressures, you know, gossip, exclusion, you know, just sort of being mean to each other sometimes, rather than the classic sort of violence that gets depicted in film or in TV. I think some of those social pressures are much more compelling. In a minimum security women's prison, or even in the high, I did find myself in two high security women's facilities as well during the course of my prison journey. But those things are really powerful. You know, the prison in which you live is the society in which you are, you know, participants. And so if there's a whispering campaign of gossip against you, let's say, that can be very, very powerful. It sounds like high school, but, you know, it matters a lot. So, I think that prisons really show a spectrum. I think a minimum security women's federal facility is probably among the least violent of all prisons. Obviously, a maximum security men's prison, particularly perhaps a state prison, is probably going to be a very, very violent place. I was on a panel discussion recently with a guy who had served 14 years in a New York State maximum security prison, and he said he couldn't recall a single day that he didn't see an act of violence, so whether it was from a guard or whether it was from another prisoner. So it varies. It varies a lot. But those are sort of the things that you're looking out for. Of course, you know, there's also sort of the institutional sanctions that can happen, things like being locked up in the segregated housing unit, the SHU, the whole solitary, which is terrible. It's a terrible thing.
And you were in a minimum security facility most of the time in Danbury, Connecticut.
Mm-hmm. Most of the time in Danbury, Connecticut, 11 months. Then near the end of my sentence, I found myself transported on Conair. The federal government does operate a secret private transport, you know, airline in essence, to move prisoners around the country. And I found myself moved first to Oklahoma City, which is where the Federal Transfer Center is hubbed, kind of like FedEx for prisoners. And then ultimately I found myself living in a federal jail in Chicago, which is definitely the worst place I've ever been in my life. And that was a really different kettle of fish than the federal facility in Denver that I was living in, and probably much closer to the average conditions of confinement in this country.
And what was the reason for the transfer?
I was appearing as a witness in a trial.
Mm. Talk a little bit about what you learned about the other women that were there in prison, the relationships you developed, but what you learned about those women and the strength that they had to bring to bear to serve their time.
Yeah, people sometimes ask me if I'm glad for the experience, if I'm grateful for the experience of having been sent to prison. And I always say, you know, if I could go back in time and change things, I absolutely would, if only for the simple fact of, you know, not having put my family through this kind of an ordeal. But that said, I'm incredibly grateful for the people that I met, for the women that I met along the way, and for some of the friendships that I formed with them, because, you know, they changed my life. They helped me understand the consequences of my own actions in a much more concrete and real way, because so many of the women that I met had either struggled directly with drug addiction themselves, or had, you know, drugs and drug addiction had completely transformed their own lives, and that was a tough thing to sort of grapple with and to acknowledge my own complicity in that. I think some of the fascinating things about living in that kind of a community of women, an incredibly, frankly, mixed community, certainly very racially mixed, very mixed in terms of social class. I was certainly not the only middle-class woman in prison. There were other middle-class women, but it's seriously a mixed bag. People from rural areas, people from urban areas, old women and young women, you know, basically girls of 18 and 19 years old. Sort of watching how they negotiate each other. And, of course, prisons are incredibly crowded places with very scarce resources. I mean, one of the reasons for conflict in prison is the simple fact that resources are extremely scarce and people are competing for them. But, you know, I found that, by and large, the majority of the women that I met were simply trying to navigate a really bad experience and, in general, would collaborate with other women to try and make that better. And so, while there were certainly conflicts that happened, you know, every day, there were also ways in which people would, you know, the women that I met would work together to sort of try and carve out a little bit of happiness in a really unhappy place, whether that was through cooking. You know, there were two little microwaves for about 200 women in the unit. And women would really produce remarkable feasts out of those microwaves and cook for their friends and try to recreate some of the dishes, maybe Caribbean dishes or Latino dishes, that they were homesick for. You know, women would talk about their children a lot. The majority of women in prison have children, and actually most of them had primary custody of their children before they were locked up. And so women would do things like, you know, you're able to buy a crochet needle at the commissary. And so there were elaborate sort of crochet circles, and people would generally be making things for their kids. Obviously, some women are very involved in faith and religious worship, and so that is not a community I participated in very actively, but I did observe it, and it was interesting. So that was, to me, one of the things that's most fascinating about my experience, and definitely one of the things I wanted to write about and capture, because I don't think it's often considered the steps that people take to make their prison experience more human and more survivable. We often think about the things that are most brutal about prisons, and rightly so. You know, I think it would be wrong to ignore or deny those things, but I think the things that made people human and the things that people did to hold on to their humanity were among the most interesting things that I participated in or observed while I was a prisoner.
And, of course, the corollary to that is this environment in which you essentially have no control over your own life, that everything
really
is dictated to you.
Yes, absolutely. And a huge amount of effort on the part of prisoners to try to create some sense of control over their own over their own life. But it's a little bit of a false paradigm, because there's really just about There's almost nothing that can't be taken away from you in that setting. Other than, you know, sort of the health of your, the, you know, the world of your own mind is sort of one thing that they can't really take away from you. But right down to the body, you know, you can be restrained to a tremendous degree. You know, physically, even right down to that, you are considered state property.
Was there any anger that you brought to this with respect to the drug laws and to the prosecution itself that you carried with you into prison?
For myself, you know, I committed my offense. My offense was not one that was born out of economic necessity, but rather a misguided sense of adventure and wanting to have, you know, wanting to see sort of the dark side of life and wanting to become a more worldly person. I look back on my young self, and it's sort of astounding sort of how careless and how naive I was. So it's hard for me to feel a lot of bitterness about it. Also, I spent 1 year in prison, which is a very short sentence, I learned, on my very first day in prison. I found myself standing next to women who were serving certain sentences of 7 years and 10 years, and I had to ask myself right away, what could she possibly have done to have earned a sentence so much longer than mine? And I think the harsh truth, especially as I grew to know these women better and better, is that there's probably nothing. The difference is difference of you know, the quality of the attorney you get and the way that you are evaluated by the court and by the prosecutor as you're getting through that sentencing process. And I think that's one of the most disturbing things about the criminal justice system in this country, is that two people can stand before the same bench and will not necessarily receive the same quality of justice. And so that's something that I can't really put out of my mind or forget. I think I'll carry that with me, you know, for the rest of my life. And that sort of very, very direct knowledge and experience, that there were some women in that prison who were serving a lot more time than me, and not necessarily for good reasons, but rather for reasons of race and class. I do think that the drug laws, I think that locking up nonviolent drug offenders is incredibly wasteful. And it's wasteful of taxpayer dollars, because it's very, very expensive to incarcerate people, as I'm sure all Californians know. Mm-hmm. You have a uniquely dramatic situation out here. But, you know, a situation that most state governments are actually going through, though not in quite such a dramatic fashion. But it's very expensive to lock up nonviolent drug offenders, and especially when I consider some of the women that I did time with, the idea that they were menaces to society is kind, or criminal masterminds is ludicrous. And so the idea that there could not be more affordable and more effective alternative sanctions, things like probation and parole in the community, those things would be much more, you know, certainly much cheaper and very likely much more effective than incarceration. Also, I have to say that it's my opinion that prisons have been used as a solution for many of the problems of poverty, the chronic problems of poverty. Drug abuse and addiction, you know, and many of the other crimes that are associated with poverty. And prisons aren't a good remedy for those problems. There are other things that need to be done to address those issues, and it's not so simple as locking a person up.
Piper Kerman, her memoir is Orange is the New Black, My Year in a Women's Prison. Piper, I thank you so much for spending time with us today.
Oh, Jeff, thanks for all your thoughtful questions. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.